You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from The Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that because you're already listening to a podcast.
Hey there, everybody. Quick explanation. I promised you a short episode about 20th century medicine shows to round out the series, and you'll get that in 2 weeks. For today, I've rewritten, re-recorded, and reproduced an early episode of this show, one of the episodes I'm most proud of, but one that needed a good bit of scrubbing, and one that I've spent the last week or so thinking about. So, here goes. It's January of 1867, when you first catch sight of her, and you love her as quick as that. Eliza. You are a 17-year-old boy from Cornwall, and although you know there are prettier out there, and richer, and younger, Eliza's got something none of them have. She's yours. Some of the other men laugh at her. Some of them scoff. Some of them turn away in disgust. But not you. You walk right up to her, and one of the older men puts a hand on your shoulder. She's no good, boy. You brush by him, and on to the ship. You've been waiting your whole life to sail these waters, and Eliza, old but freshly painted, her three masts gently teetering back and forth against the Cornish sky, is your way to the ocean, to the winds, to peace and freedom and adventure and adulthood. On deck, you can barely contain your excitement. And in that, you are thoroughly alone. The crew around you are hung low like loose sails. It isn't the casual indifference of experience. It's something sadder, darker. It's the same on shore. You notice when you run to the side to wave elatedly to the people watching from the docks. You've seen off hundreds of ships from that dock over the years, wishing them well, wishing them luck, wishing to be not on the dock, but exactly where you are now. But the folks looking back at you are quiet, still, and somber. You see one old man with a big, bushy beard shake his head slowly, and then drop it to his chin. The Eliza shoves off. With you at her topsail, working the line, there's a commotion on deck. The bosun tells the captain that one of the men, Larry, is not on board. Larry, who only 15 minutes ago put his hand on your shoulder. He must have made a run for it, the bosun guesses. Then Larry's the only man of us who'll be alive in a week, whispers one of the mates. And he's right. The Eliza set off on Friday, January 3rd, 1867. By Sunday, she was lost with all hands. And no one but you, not the crew, nor the captain, nor the ship's owner, nor the people looking on solemnly from the dock that day, expected anything else. This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Today's episode, Shipwreckless. I can tell you what happened to the Eliza, that a wind broke her fore and mid-top masts, that she attempted to make her way to St. Ives, that she eventually laid anchor hoping to outlast the weather before it finally whipped her back to the open sea. But that doesn't get to the why of the Eliza, and it doesn't help at all to explain the larger trend of which she was but a very small part. The story of the Eliza is exceptionally unexceptional. In 1867, 2,513 cargo ships went down off the coast of England, with a total of 1,333 hands. That's to say nothing of ships traveling to Europe, or the Americas, or India. And 1867 is as unexceptional a year in this regard as the Eliza is a ship. Every year around this period laid claim to similar numbers of wrecks and similar numbers of casualties. But it wasn't always that way. Complete records of ships foundering are almost impossible to come by. Trust me, I've looked. But there are tidbits available. Look at the coast of Florida, for example. In the whole of the 17th century, there are 67 recorded wrecks. In the 18th, 241. And the 19th, 1,045. Now, those numbers deserve an asterisk, as the Florida coast and the Caribbean both grew substantially as trade waters over the centuries. There were more ships around to sink in the 1800s than the 1700s. But not five times as many. And similar trends show around the world. Shipping was increasing in England, in France, in America, but more ships were sinking than were being added. A lot more. In short, from the late 1700s up through the 1870s, in spite of technological advances, in spite of increased lifeboat presences, in spite of every reason to expect the opposite, sailing was getting increasingly dangerous. Pirates? You want it to be pirates, right? That's okay, that's only natural. Everybody loves pirates. But no, it wasn't about pirates. Maybe you're thinking it's a question of a century and a half of increasingly bad weather. Probably not, because that's ridiculous. But at the time, plenty of people, including the English Board of Trade and the National Lifeboat Institute, thought that might be it. Nope, not weather. Not pirates, not increased traffic, not steamliners, not crew changes or increases in drinking or anything so obvious. By the 19th century, hundreds of ships were sinking unnecessarily every year and taking hundreds of sailors with them. And to grasp the germ, the beginning of the trouble, that fly the old lady swallowed, we have to travel east from Cornwall to London and back to the 1680s. To this place. A coffee shop. In 1688, there were around 80 coffee shops in London, but only one of them is of interest to us. The one on Tower Street, owned by George Lloyd. In some ways, coffee houses of the 17th and 18th centuries were the same as they are today, which is that they were just as much places to hang out for hours and hours as they were places to actually, like, drink coffee. But instead of being populated by freeloading teenagers and deluded would-be novelists, the old coffee houses of London were meeting spots for various tradesmen, politicians, and merchants. Mostly merchants, who would do their business, take meetings, eavesdrop, all on the public grounds of the coffee shops. So, if you were the owner of a coffee shop, your success depended as much on what information people could get there as how good the bean juice was. And that, it seems, was the genius of George Lloyd. There wasn't much written about the quality of his coffee, no ads run featuring his brewing or roasting expertise. In 1692, he moved his shop to Lombard Street, where all the big boys in the coffee world played, and began to dominate them all, entirely through his reputation for being well-informed and savvy in all things business. Instead of running ads in newspapers, he started printing his own newspaper, a two-page broadsheet called Lloyd's News that came out twice a week. A typical edition covered a broad range of subjects in brief: news from the legislature, international headlines, rewards for lost dogs. Lloyd's News was shut down after a few short years. Press freedom in 17th century England was less than robust. But in that short runtime, you can see the trend forming. More and more of the print gets taken up by international news, trade, and ports. Over the course of its short life, Lloyd's News increasingly focused on one subject: shipping. And the same trend held for Lloyd's Coffee House. There was a coffee house up the street for government types, and one for auctions. But Lloyd's Coffee House was the place for all things maritime: sailors, captains, merchants, and shipowners. Here was a place to gather a crew. to charter a boat, to haggle over cargo. Most of all, and most importantly, here was a place to insure a ship. This coffee shop is the humble origin of Lloyd's of London, one of the grandfathers of the modern insurance industry. By the 1730s, Lloyd's wasn't just where you went to get marine news, but marine insurance. In 1734, Lloyd's List, the descendant of Lloyd's News, a journal now entirely about the shipping community, appeared. And it's still printed today. Are you lost? Remember, we're here to answer why the Eliza and several thousand other ships a year were needlessly sunk throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, and yet we've only made our way from coffee to insurance. Don't worry, we're closer than it seems. In the 1750s, a new insurance practice came about, birthed right there in the middle of Lloyd's. It worked like this. A man's got a ship and is set up to deliver something, say iron, from Cornwall to, I don't know, Cardiff. It's a good deal, and he stands to make a bunch, but only if the ship makes it to port. If it sinks, he's screwed. So he needs some insurance. He walks into Lloyd's with papers explaining the gains and potential risks, as well as the worth of the ship. Then investors there sign up to take portions of that risk, which they agree to take on. If the ship sinks, they have to pay up their portion. But in exchange, they're paid a fee from the premium as soon as they write their names under what they're taking on. Right under. Underwriters. Ships are expensive things, and their cargoes are hopefully valuable. So if you're an investor, you probably don't want to put up the whole of the value on your own. Underwriting allowed bankers to spread out the cost of insuring a journey across smaller, more digestible, and profitable bits. And it allowed ship owners and merchants to more easily protect their property. Everybody wins. Except, not everybody. It is in this former coffee shop that the fate of you, you 17-year-old overeager sailor from Cornwall, you, and your fellow mates and the Eliza herself were sealed on a sheet of paper underwritten by some motley gang of investors and bankers. I should note that there was no 17-year-old overeager sailor, or maybe there was, but if so, it's a coincidence. He's a device. The Eliza, though, was a real ship, and though some of the finer details are taken from similar sinkings, the thrust of her story is, in the main, accurate. And while I'm at it, noting this thing and that thing like so, maybe I should also note that this wasn't the first time that the Eliza sank. In fact, one year previous, in 1866, Eliza foundered the first time under a different name. She was raised and sold cheap to new owners, who did a minimal amount of repair work, slapped on a fresh coat of paint, rechristened her Eliza, and sent her off to work. No, I'm missing a step. Before sending her off to work, they had her underwritten. Between the repairs, the paint, and the paperwork, Eliza's owners put about £7,000 sterling into their investment. But they insured her for £10,000. Any seasoned sailor, and indeed anyone used to working the docks, could take one look at the ship and see she was doomed to go under. She sat low in the water. She was weary and broken on sight. She was being sent out to sea to die, an eventuality for which her owners would be richly rewarded. And her crew? Well, who really cared? But why would the crews get on at all, knowing what was in store? For one thing, they needed the money. Anyway, by the time you, as a sailor, saw the ship you were assigned to, you'd already signed the contract. If you breached, you'd face jail time because you probably didn't have the money to pay the fine. And 19th century British jails were a death gambit too. So if it looked like a ship could possibly make the crossing as long as the waters remained calm, there was some tricky arithmetic for you to longhand. Sail, and you risk death, but also a paycheck. Refuse and risk death with no reward besides. If the weather was calm enough, you might just make it. There are accounts of ships being escorted by police boats out of harbor while sailors pleaded with them to please be arrested instead. We're talking about murder here. Murder for profit. There's no more delicate way to put it. And there was a lot of murder for profit. In 1875, the secretary of Lloyd's of London said he didn't know of a ship in the last 30 years which had been voluntarily broken up. Between at least 1845 and 1875, the universal practice was to sell off broken and unworthy vessels down the line over and over until they finally ended up in the hands of someone craven or desperate enough to shove a crew of men out to sea to drown. The sailors and coastal communities had a name for these: coffin ships. The coffin ships, though, were only the most conspicuous and despicable tip of a much larger problem. We'll be right back. Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Life can be overwhelming, and many people are feeling burned out without even knowing it. I know I am. I have those days where I have some simple task to achieve, and I just stare at it for like hours. Symptoms of burnout can include a lack of motivation, irritability, fatigue, and more. We associate burnout with work, but that's not the only cause. Any of our roles in life can lead us to feeling burned out. BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you to prioritize yourself. Talking with someone can help you figure out what's causing stress in your life. I found therapy to be great for locating the problems or just for talking through them. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/theconstant. That's betterhelp.com/theconstant. You've looked at your business's hiring from every angle, but there's something you feel like you're missing. In your core, you know it could be faster. You're right. You need Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring partner that can help you do it all. Find great talent faster through time-saving tools like Indeed Instant Match assessments and virtual interviews. With Instant Match, over 80% of employers get quality candidates whose resume on Indeed matches their job description the moment they sponsor a job, according to Indeed Data US. One great thing about Indeed is the virtual interviews. They save you time by letting you message, schedule, and interview top talent seamlessly, all in one place. Even better, Indeed's the only job site where you only pay for applications that meet your must-have requirements. Indeed is an unbelievably powerful hiring partner, delivering 4 times more hires than all other job sites combined, according to TalentNest 2019. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Sign up for Indeed now and get a $75 credit towards your first sponsored job. Plus, earn up to $500 extra in sponsored job credits with Indeed's virtual interviews. Visit Indeed.com/theconstant to learn more. Claim your credits at Indeed.com/theconstant. Indeed.com/theconstant. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Starting in the 18th century, and rapidly escalating through the 19th, it became standard practice to take old, beat-up ships, insure them beyond their true value, and shove them off to sink. Maybe you're already asking yourself, why would the underwriters go along with this? Because not only was this murder, but insurance fraud to boot. And fine, so the sailors didn't have the power to stand up to the owners and captains, but why not the bankers and underwriters? Let's go back to the Eliza and take a look. She sinks in 1866, is raised, sold, passingly repaired, repainted, rechristened, and then her owners go out to an insurance broker to get a policy. First, the owner asks for £12,500, and the broker talks him down to an even 10. Still £3,000 more than he's paid for her. Then, the broker takes that policy to Lloyd's of London, the old coffee shop, which is now England's biggest and practically its only marine insurance headquarters. Inside Lloyd's is a long, long room full of suitably long tables and offices at which underwriters sit and which the broker can pass the policy down all the way around. He's out to get 10 grand of underwriting, and the offer goes from one investor to the next. Some pass on it, while others agree to take on a small portion of the total policy. By the time it gets through the process, Eliza's insurance policy may have 50, even 100 underwriters, most of whom are in for just 50 or £100 each. Which means that when the Eliza sinks, no one individual person is on the hook for more than a bit of chump change. And just as an individual signs or passes on that policy, another comes down the line. Underwriters typically signed on for 20, 30, 50, even 100 policies every day. That each policy was underwritten by so many insurers, and each insurer underwrote so many policies, made for a perfect storm of inaction. An underwriter didn't have time to investigate the ship or the owner he was insuring because he had too many other policies to deal with. And if something happened to one, he was out so little money that there was no way to justify a costly investigation to make sure he hadn't been defrauded. Moreover, each individual underwriter was but a solitary person. Probably fairly well off, but just a person. Meanwhile, the ships were owned by large freight firms, or tremendously wealthy individuals, who had every reason to fight any investigation down to their eye teeth and all the means to do so. And we're talking about shipwrecks here. How is someone supposed to go out and determine there was something fishy going on when the very thing they're investigating is literally fishy now? The boat is sunk, the crew is dead. How is an underwriter to prove his case? In contrast, the ship's owners can defend themselves by saying, the other underwriters paid up, so what's wrong with this guy? And hey, that hypothetical holdout, he already took the premium. He already said the ship was good to go. What does it mean if, after a ship is lost, he says, no, it was a fraud? Well, it means that he didn't do his due diligence in the first place, because, as we know, he couldn't. Or that he's trying to get stingy. On top of all of that, the underwriter had an active disincentive against challenging claims. The broker. The broker who brought the policy in got paid on commission, so he had no skin in the game other than to keep things moving smoothly. And if an underwriter got a reputation for holding up claims, even if there was fraud that everyone could agree upon, then he was someone to pass over the next time you brought some money in. Which, of course, would be later that day, and then again a little later that day, and again, challenging claims was a good way for an underwriter to lose their entire business. What we're looking at here is one of the earliest examples of what we now call a moral hazard. That is, a system which passes and diffuses risk such that it encourages greater exposure to risk and fraud. In the 1870s and before, very few people had a sense that economic systems could adversely affect behavior. Free will and the free market should have kept everyone doing good by themselves and others, and any deviations should have been punished and righted by the marketplace. But that isn't what happened. And while the coffin ships were the most striking example of the problem, they weren't the brunt. The bigger issue of the underwriting business was not the sanctuary and playground it gave for sociopathic murderers. It was the more subtle ways it pushed otherwise decent folks into taking things only a bit too far. Shipping freight was always a business that existed on a knife's edge. You wanted to move enough cargo on a ship that the charter would be profitable. But the more weight you put on the boat, the lower in the water it sat, the greater the risk there was of it sinking. And a sunk ship was a big loss, not only of the cargo, but of a very expensive bit of property, the ship itself. But in the 19th century, the equation of how much risk versus reward a shipper was willing to put on shifted, even if only slightly, because the risk no longer belonged to the shipper. Both the ship and the cargo were insured on someone else's dime, so why not try to load a bit more on? And since you're now paying insurance premiums, you had to put more stuff on board to keep profitable. Coffin ships were one thing, one deeply despicable thing, but overloading was a far more common threat. In 1876, the Board of Trade noted 856 merchant ships wrecked within 10 miles of shore and in conditions not much worse than a stiff breeze, all because they were packed with too much cargo to sail safely. If you made your life on the English coast as a sailor or family to a sailor or neighbor to a sailor or at a business that in any way depended on sailors, you knew this. You knew what to look for: rotted wood painted over, a hull slung deep in the water, freight gathered loosely on deck. You knew what it looked like when a ship was loaded to kill. But you didn't necessarily understand the specifics of how and why this was being allowed, let alone encouraged. And if you didn't have that close relationship with the sea, if you didn't live in a port or make your living on the ocean, you had no clue anything was amiss at all. Until Samuel Plimsoll came along.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Samuel Plimsoll wasn't anybody special. He'd been a successful brewery manager, which had made him pretty well off, and then he had been an unsuccessful coal merchant, which had made him pretty much destitute. He picked himself up into comfort again, but his time spent living in squalor among poor sailors left its mark on him. Plimsoll was in a fairly unique position of seeing what was happening at the ports and seeing what was happening at Lloyd's. But what made his position more unique was that he gave a shit. And boy, did he. He was elected to Parliament for Derby on a campaign to reform the shipping industry. Once seated in the House, he laid out for his fellow MPs exactly what was happening and how many English sailors' lives were on the line. And he showed them his plan to make things better. One, give the Board of Trade power to inspect ships for seaworthiness. Two, draw on the outside of each ship a mark indicating the point at which it is sitting too low in the water to operate safely and make it illegal to embark without clearing that mark. And three, limit the amount a ship's voyage can be insured by to 75% of its value, thus keeping some incentivizing risk on the owner's head. He believed the evidence showed they could save thousands or tens of thousands of lives. And he went further. He noted that there were no regulations on what sailors could be fed, which led to spoiled and rotten food being passed off on them. He shed light on the practice of constructing ships with devils, old, reused, rusty nails that were concealed beneath new brass heads. He explained that there were no legal standards for how a ship must be built, which led to conniving shipwrights taking advantage of ship owners who didn't care anyway because they were insured by blinded underwriters. Parliament reacted with indifference and suspicion. They refused to admit that any of this could be happening, and even if it were, the market should work it out. And even if the market weren't, they said that government meddling would only make the problem worse, would only stifle freedom, would only create laziness and complacency. Maybe it was important that many MPs were ship owners themselves, or that many more of them were in the pocket of the shipping industry. Parliament stonewalled Plimsoll for 5 years. So Plimsoll took his case to the people. In 1872, he published a book entitled Our Seamen, outlining his case and buttressed with letters, tables, statistics, and testimonies from here to kingdom come. He told the people of England that their government was unwilling and unable to take the steps necessary to remedy this great wrong, and that it was up to them to save the lives and fortunes of their fellow countrymen. And Our Seamen flew off the shelves. It was a public sensation. 1 year later, in 1873, with public protests at a fever pitch, Parliament agreed to enact a commission looking into the claims and causes suggested by Plimsoll. In 1875, the commission came back, affirming Plimsoll's argument and suggesting a law be passed. But on the Parliament floor, Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli announced he was dropping the bill. Plimsoll flew into a rage. He screamed at his fellow MPs. He called them villains. He ran up to Disraeli and shook his fist right in his face. Disraeli moved to reprimand Plimsoll, but the public was with him. They wanted action, and they weren't going away. So, in 1876, English Parliament brought and passed the Merchant Shipping Act, giving inspection power to the Board of Trade and requiring all ships to bear a load mark showing when they were laden too deep for safe travel. That mark has since been adopted internationally by nearly every government and marine agency in the world. You can see it on the prow of every merchant ship sailing every lake, river, and ocean. A circle with a line through it, commonly called the Plimsoll Line. Within a scant few years, the number of wrecks plummeted, and the number of drowned sailors along with it. Plimsoll and the people of England had risen together against moneyed interests, corrupt government, and entrenched market forces, and made the world a better, safer place. Go ahead. Draw the parallels. To Ralph Nader, who made a very similar case with the automobile industry, which said nothing could be done, that the government should not, could not, legislate to make cars safer. Ralph Nader, who took the problem to the American people and got us speed limits and seatbelts. Or to the subprime mortgage crisis, where free market incentives drove troves of bankers, realtors, and stockbrokers to nosedive the global economy. Or, look. When I first wrote, recorded, and released this episode, with the onboard microphone of a hand-me-down laptop, the United States was reeling from a shooting that killed 17 at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. As I'm working on this episode, there are a group of teenagers out there speaking to the people. A group of teenagers who just days ago witnessed friends and peers and teachers gunned down in their school, and who snapped up, as the adults of America have consistently failed to do, to point and scream and keen and shout as Plimsoll did, here is the problem. It is not a natural problem, and it need not be a permanent problem if we, the people, can sustain ourselves to the effort of rectifying it. Today, we're reeling again for the deaths of even more and even younger children. And we've reeled dozens of times in between. May 18th, 2018, Santa Fe High School, 10 dead. June 28th, 2018, Annapolis, 5 dead at the Capitol Gazette. October 27th, 2018, Pittsburgh, 11 dead at the Tree of Life Synagogue. November 7th, 2018, Thousand Oaks, California, 13 dead at a student dance. May 31st, 2019, Virginia Beach, 12 killed. August 3rd, 2019, El Paso, 23 killed at Walmart. August 4th, 2019, Dayton, Ohio, 10 killed outside a bar. August 31st, 2019, Midland, Odessa, Texas, 8 killed along Interstate 20. November 14th, 2019, Santa Clarita, California, 3 killed at Saugus High School. February 26, 2020, Milwaukee, 6 killed at the Molson Coors Brewery. March 15th, 2020, Springfield, Missouri, 5 dead at a convenience store. December 26, 2020, Rockford, Illinois, 3 killed at a bowling alley. March 16th, 2021, Atlanta, Georgia, 8 dead across 3 shootings at spas around the city. March 22nd, 2021, Boulder, Colorado, 10 killed at a King Soopers grocery store. April 7th, 2021, Rock Hill, South Carolina, 7 killed. April 15th, 2021, Indianapolis, 7 dead at a FedEx ground facility. May 26th, 2021, San Jose, 10 killed at a rail yard. November 30th, 2021, Michigan, 4 killed at Oxford High School. April 3rd, 2022, California, 6 killed in downtown Sacramento. April 12th, 2022, New York City, 29 injured at the 36th Street Station in Sunset Park. May 14th, 2022, Buffalo, New York. 10 killed at Tops Supermarket by an 18-year-old live-streaming white supremacist. May 19th, 2022, Chicago. 2 killed and 8 others injured outside the McDonald's at Chicago and State, which I walked by almost every day for 10 years. May 24th, Uvalde, Texas, 22 dead, including 19 children at Robb Elementary School. All we do is reel and point and scream and keen and shout over and over, and it makes me feel crazy. But what's actually crazy is that we don't do a thing about it. What's truly insane is the people who aren't keening. The officials who say they're very sad and then shuffle off to their next grim dealings. Hey, look, if you're skeptical of gun control, congratulations, you're right. If you're not skeptical of gun control, then wise up, because it's fucking hard. Even in a country that doesn't have the Second Amendment, a 7-3 conservative SCOTUS supermajority, and 50 million more guns than there are people. The specific actions we need to take are difficult. They need to be worked out with intellectual rigor, calm reasoning, and a butt ton of data. But the general thing we need to do is obvious. Something. Fucking something. And I don't mean that in a catch-as-catch-can, take-what-you-can-get sense. I mean that the predicate for any solution is that we keep in mind an honest view of the problem. That this is unnatural. That going to school or church or shopping or to a bar or walking down the street didn't just become more dangerous any more than sailing did in the 1800s. The state of violence in this country is an invented state, the result of policies, laws, actions, regulations, and lack thereof. And either those things are within our power to change, or we aren't a country anymore. Maybe we're not. But if so, we've got to keep screaming until our heads are fully underwater. Systems can change the nature of people, but people, too, can change the nature of systems. From Chicago, Illinois, where last year 712 people were killed by guns. This has been The Constant.